that in our culture, where we don't have this same worldview, the same cosmology, we're more likely, and I think it is more appropriate for us to look at what we're calling inner interpretations of this text, rather than the outer. I don't mean to dismiss the outer, but I want to highlight the inner. So that one comment that was made, for instance, with regard to verse 5, with some friends the three poisons keep growing: study, reflection, and meditation. Weaken, loving kindness and compassion fall away, give up bad friends. This is the practice of a bodhisattva. Now, in almost any commentary that you're going to get from a traditional perspective, it would be taken just as that. But at least one person, I think two or three people, said, well, yeah, but I can also see this as applying to patterns, because that's who we hang out with a lot. And I just wanted to highlight that and say that this is a very appropriate and I think a very helpful way to look at this, to be looking at it at that level as well. I just didn't feel I'd given sufficient support for that last time. So following the way that we approached it last week, these three verses, are there any conceptual points or translation points or anything in the text you're curious about, you'd like to ask? Catherine?
Your translation in the 10th stanza about give rise to awakening mind, and in the Dalai Lama's translation, and then the other one I had, it was altruistic intention. And then I found a lot about altruistic intention that was written in the book of the words of my perfect teacher, and the Dalai Lama had a lot to say about it, so I wondered what you were thinking.
Okay.
I know that's probably a big deal.
It is, but it's an important matter. The Sanskrit term here is bodhicitta. The Tibetan is jangchub sem, and the English translation that I've evolved to is awakening mind. Now, you're right, there's a big topic here. Bodhicitta, you have the two words, bodhi and citta. Bodhi is the word for awakening. For many years, most of us translated as enlightenment, but awakening is the more appropriate English, and citta is the word for mind. Now, there are many, many words for mind, and even that there's many meanings for citta or sem in Tibetan. In this context, was it the altruistic attitude?
Intention.
Yes, it can be thought of as an intention or an attitude or a way of approaching things. Now, the reason that it's been translated as altruistic is that the idea is one is in bodhicitta is you discover the possibility of awakening in yourself. And with that discovery, you understand that this is the only way to be free of suffering. So you naturally want all other people to experience it too. And so it's a very, very expansive quality, very inclusive quality. And out of it evolves what we call the Bodhisattva vow, which is, which is the vow to awaken this attitude in everyone. And the only way to do that is to achieve awakening yourself. So it's the vow to wake up completely in order to be able to help all others wake up. Now that's why it is translated as altruistic. Personally, I feel that altruistic is to Bodhi or awakening mind as skim milk is to cream. That's just my personal feeling about the relative weight in the words. And I think awakening has a lot more power. It also includes another aspect which altruism just doesn't embrace in English at all. And that is that this awakening mind, or this mind of awakening, which might be a better way of putting it, but it's just clumsy in English, has two aspects. There is the experience of awakening, which means there's an experience of knowing what experience is. What is experience? Experience is empty. When you know experience is empty, that is freeing and filling at the same time, because all things become possible. So it's freeing and enriching. A lot of people think of emptiness as a negative, but it really isn't. So that aspect of awakening mind doesn't come through the word altruism at all, which is why I declined to use that term. Okay?
That reminds me of the beginning when we have emptiness and compassion are together.
Yeah, that's right.
And I kept seeing that in a lot of places.
Yeah.
It's everywhere.
Yeah. Out of that direct understanding, then naturally arises compassion, which is, everybody's got to experience this. Yes.
So, but that the premise is out of the awakening mind, something we were talking about, it's a cause and effect of awakening mind is compassion, or is it?
Well, yes and no. Sorry, the usual Buddhist answer. You can cultivate awakening mind through developing compassion. And when awakening mind arises, compassion arises even more strongly. So it operates both ways. That's why I say yes and no. I've been talking about it as awakening mind, that discovery of that possibility as the genesis for a very deep form of compassion. But if you read Control in the Great Path of Awakening, he is recommending that you cultivate taking and sending, because through that you engender compassion, and with that engenderment of compassion you open the door to having this level of awakening mind. So it depends which way you want to work it, and you can work it both. In the Zen tradition, they work it from discovering that awakening. In the Tibetan tradition, it's much more about cultivating the compassion leading into that.
But is there awakening mind? Is there an awakened mind that is not cultivating compassion?
That would be a contradiction in terms. You aren't awake to how things are. if you aren't experiencing compassion. Yeah, I mean, that's just true. Okay. Any other points in this? Joe?
So could we say if we recognized or experienced exactly how things are, that we had no separate existence, a concomitant of that would be that we were connected. And if we actually recognize the fact that we were connected, we would recognize that any harm we did would be done to ourselves. And the opposite of that, we would not, the result, we would do no harm.
Yes. Basically, that's right. I just want to be careful about the language, because there are a lot of slippery things in the way that you articulate it. And when we go through the in terms of practice experience through verses 8 and 9, that point's going to come out very clearly. So, but what you're saying is right. I'll just clean up the language a little bit. When you say we wouldn't be separate, well, actually we aren't separate. But we experience ourselves as separate, so that's what drops. Is that the framework which causes us to experience things? And to say then, when we do others harm, we're actually harming ourselves. That can easily slide into a kind of rather naive New Age form of thinking, which I'm sure isn't what you intended, but it has that danger. It is more accurate to say that when we do harm to another, we initiate a process which creates suffering for ourselves and others. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Okay.
The words spaciousness and also wisdom, are they synonymous really with emptiness?
I would say it depends who's using them. In my experience, quite often when people use the word spacious in describing their experience, they're actually talking about a certain kind of dullness. Dullness. And so I get a little curious at that point. Not always, but quite often. At the same time, the word spacious is a pretty useful word for translating certain vocabulary in Dzogchen. Where you have this, was it Chuang Tzu, the treasury of the space of all experience. Big. Wisdom, again, it depends a little bit on how it's being used. When you're talking about wisdom in the sense of the perfection of wisdom, it means knowing emptiness directly. Now, you get into some nice philosophical things about, is knowing emptiness equal emptiness? Well, in a certain sense it is, but you're going to talk about it in a slightly different way, if you see what I mean. I think part of your question is, like, what is emptiness, right? Well, you may think this is being a little glib, but I mean this in all seriousness. Emptiness is not a thing. And you need to take that one in very, very deeply. Because the human tendency, whenever you hear a word, You know, empty, you may make it into a noun. Nouns are things, so now emptiness has suddenly become a thing. And it becomes an object of study, etc., etc. Emptiness actually is much more a description. But it's not a thing. And it points, and that's why I say a description, it points to an aspect of experience that we consistently ignore or simply are not aware of. And what is that aspect of experience? It's that what arises, nothing that arises in experience is a thing either, but that's how we experience it. Michelle?
My understanding is that the Hopi language has no nouns, that the way you describe something like a tree translates roughly as it grows.
Mm-hmm.
Is that analogous to what you're talking about?
I don't know enough about the Hopi language. In fact,
no.
I know
I
nothing.
Told you everything I know.
Yeah, well, I know less than that. I don't know. Is it analogous to what I'm doing? I don't see it. Okay. But that may be just because I'm thick tonight. Okay. Other points, translation points, or questions about the text? Conceptual questions. Pure as mud, right? Okay. When you reflected on any of these verses, what came up? Now, we may not get through everybody, but something absolutely came up for everybody. If somebody says, no, nothing came up, then suppose you didn't do it. So, what do you got?
In verse 8, for that reason, even if your life is at risk, don't engage in destructive actions. When I read, even if your life is at risk, I mean, I've read it before, and, you know, the Bodhicaryavatara talks a lot about it. Every time I read it, I get kind of simultaneously just totally afraid. And also depressed, because I don't think I, you know, if my life was at risk, I know I would engage in destructive actions.
Pardon?
I know I would, as, you know, as I sit here today. So I guess I get self-critical.
Yeah. You want to comment on that? Protect your practice?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
I meant.
Pardon?
That's what I meant.
That's what you meant, yes. Okay.
And it's just a different way to look at life than it is.
Yeah.
And the only way to live is to die.
You coming on Sunday?
To the
Warrior Solution?
Was
It's right on topic.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's exactly this point. Maybe you should come. Okay. Give me an example of a circumstance in which you would do a destructive action if your life were at risk. You just read that and said,
"I just read it." And I just,
okay,
you
know. That was not reflecting. Okay, but
yeah.
Give me see because you notice. Okay, when would I actually do that?
It could be.
I'll come to you, Chuck, in a second. Just
mm-hmm.
Yeah, I want to torture her a little bit.
You can torture me.
Okay. So when would you do that?
If somebody was, you know, putting me down, I would put them down, respond in that manner.
Okay. So, when it came down to your survival, you would drop into anger or whatever. Okay. Can you imagine acting in the same circumstance without anger? Even doing the same thing?
You mean putting them down without anger?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, well, I could imagine responding to them in a direct way, maybe not putting them down, but certainly responding, you know, in an honest way without anger.
Okay. Now, picking up on what Janaki was referring to, suppose somebody insults you. What's the natural thing most of us do in that circumstance?
Get defensive.
Yeah. Or snap back at them in some way. Harsh speech, slander, whatever, you know. You know the 10 non-virtuous acts, okay? That's destructive action. Why do we do that?
Because we're, you know, we feel hurt, and so we want to hurt back.
Yeah. In other words, and this is what we'll be talking about a bit in the Warrior Solution, you're not willing to experience what is arising for you. You're not willing to experience that discomfort and die in that experience. You know, we collapse down onto our ordinary sense of ourselves and kill the other person. Do this all the time. Okay. So I think this is what Janaki is referring to when saying, well, our life is already at risk. Our awakened life. Phrases, and Clint, this goes to your question last week, how do you work with this? Okay, you read a phrase, for that reason, if your life is at risk, don't engage in destructive actions. You think, what? That's totally unreasonable, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's what we do. I mean, that's just stupid. It's really important to live. Well, these people were actually pretty serious when they wrote this kind of thing. And so the first step in when we have that, which is an experience of not being able to take it in, okay? Now, in the reflection stage, I mean, we understand the words, that's easy. In the reflection stage, we've got to make that our own, which means that we have to work through what is not allowing us to take it in. Now, I suggested one way of helping to do that. Say, okay, even if your life is at risk, don't engage in destructive actions. I think, okay. Let's suppose my life is at risk. to the point that I would engage in destructive actions. What would that actually look like? What is such a case? That's one way. Maybe that's the mathematician in me, because one of the things you learn when you're in mathematics training is when you can't find the solution to a problem, you say, well, I can't find a solution, but maybe I can figure out what the solution has to look like. And so you think, okay, what would this look like? What is such a case? And that's going to lead you in a whole different direction, just as you noticed, okay? And then another way to reflect on it leads you into the other side of things. Okay, why do I engage in destructive actions? You know, what actually happens when I put somebody down? What happens when I kill somebody's trust? What happens when I, what's happening in me when I want something that somebody else has? And when you look at that, it doesn't take long to see that I don't want to experience something. And it means that I go into this action because I go to sleep. Okay? Now, what's my life about? Well, it's meant to be about being awake, so. You see, you follow? Okay. So those are a couple of ways. Okay. Chuck.
Well, I was thinking of a situation where you might have to, where in a situation of self-defense, you might engage in destructive action.
Well, I happened to be at a talk given by the Dalai Lama when he was asked one of these stupid reporter questions, which I thought he handled with consummate skill. He said, if you were at the standing at the door of the Strategic Air Command thing in NORAD, you know, under Colorado, and you saw that one of the generals was about to push the button to launch a nuclear war, and you had a pistol, a gun, would you use it? And you see what I mean about one of these stupid reporter questions.
Right.
Okay. And the Dalai Lama without any sense of irritation or mockery or anything like that said, if it was clear that there was no other alternative, I would give it very serious consideration. Now, in the Mahayana, and I don't know this point in the Theravada well enough, maybe somebody here does. I've got to take this one up with Jason when we do our program together. But in the Mahayana, anyway, the morality of an action is determined both by the action, the nature of the action itself, and the motivation in it that propels it. And that's why I was asking Kate about that. So, if a person is attacking you, or a group of other people, or what have you, and you go, this is wrong, and you stop him, perhaps even by violence, but you're not coming out of anger. That's a very different matter from getting angry about it. You follow?
Dave and I discussed this earlier. We came to,
and I'm sure many of you have had the same experience. When that happens, everybody else looks at you and say, "How'd you know how to do that?" and something like that. It's because you were clear not clouded by your obscurations. And so you do what is completely natural and is often the only reasonable course of action. But the others, clouded by their anger or defensiveness or clinging to one thing or another, can't see that as a possibility. Oh, okay. Nava.
I also would quote this verse, and the way I use it, I look during the day, body, mind, and speech, I saw places that I definitely didn't like. And the harm I did was just being caught in thoughts, in planning.
That's right. Yes.
Fear of dying, that it was so clear and simple. The first time, you know, I made that connection, actually.
Yeah.
Very strong connection. And my question is, you know, what is that in that dying, in that moment of dying? Because we don't, I mean, you explain it, but we don't think about it, that actually we do. So this is not in our mind.
No, you're that's right, yeah.
There's some knowledge also.
Well, let's look at it from both sides. When we don't die, that is when we say the wrong thing or what have you, it's because our attention has collapsed onto any or all of three things. These are the three marks of existence.
Of what?
Three marks of existence. We are either concerned with, it feels like we have to act this way in order to survive physically, in order to get our emotional needs met, or in order to be somebody, to maintain our identity. Now, most situations, those aren't actually, none of those are actually in play, but we think they are. So, when we're clear, they're relatively, in our lives, there are relatively few situations we encounter where we're actually physically at risk of dying. But what helps with that is the recognition, well, I'm going to die anyway. You know, I'm not going to survive this life. A friend of mine would apply this to relationships. And he would say, what is the one thing you know, about this relationship you're just getting into? What's the one thing you know about it? What do you think? It's going to end. You know, it may end with my death. It may end with the other person's death. Or it may end for any number of reasons before then. But that is the one thing you know about it. Okay. If you are in a relationship and you know that it's going to end, what is the appropriate thing to do in that relationship?
Pop a bottle of
champagne.
Yeah. Basically, and the word that he used was savor it. You know, whatever it is. Because it's not going to be there sometime in the future. And so, if we can start in cultivating that attitude, whatever arises, experience, savor it. You can even savor unpleasant things. They get kind of interesting. You know, if we have all these foods and we have bitter foods and things like that, you know, and sometimes we enjoy them because they add something else to life. Now, emotional needs met, one can say most of the suffering in the world is generated because people are trying to get their emotional needs met. Can you ever get your emotional needs met?
Yeah.
No, because they were formed in the past. It's gone. And all you're trying to do is recover the past. That takes you out of the present, and it never works. All it does is bend yourself and everybody else out of shape, and that's suffering. So that comes down to, well, there's no sense in acting this way because I'm just trying to get my emotional needs met, and that's not going to happen anyway. And then the other one is identity, image. How could he say that to me? And anything else you want. And from the Buddhist point of view, who is there to be? You follow? So if we deeply inculcate those, cultivate those in us, we become more able to recognize when those are being triggered. And I'll give you an example from my coaching. There's a woman who was kicking up a fuss because she wasn't feeling that she was being treated the right way where she was working. And she said, you know, when they started affecting the way that I earn my livelihood, that's when I dig in, Ken. And I said, oh, that's very interesting. Are you telling me that if you lost this job, you wouldn't be able to get another one? She said, nonsense, Ken. I'm very good at my job. I'd get another job just like that. Oh, then how are they messing with your livelihood? Oh. So she was locked into identity about that job, and she would collapse onto that and kick up a fuss about really meaningless stuff because she wasn't thinking in the larger picture. You follow? So if you think of the work on the six realms, you may find this useful. When you feel like killing somebody, you can, which is hell realm stuff, right? And you can say, what am I opposing? Do I need to oppose this? Is opposing called for at all? And you find that that will often change. And then there are comparable things you can say for other emotions. But that gets you out of your own identification of those things. Now, the whole point of meditation is to build up a capacity in attention so that you can experience the fear of dying and not act on it. It's not to get rid of the fear. It's to be able to experience the fear, but not have to act on it.
And not
what? Have to act on it. Okay, that makes sense? Okay, good. John.
When you suggest that attitude in going into a relationship, it seems to me that you're falling into the number nine. You're looking for happiness when indeed that is really advisable. It also seems like, you know, if you're opening up a bottle of champagne, falling into another trap.
Well, yes.
I mean, you know, that just
depends on your intention.
Yeah. But
Corbell, you might be a dog or whatever.
You say number nine, verse number nine?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, there's a difference between let's turn to verse number nine. Pardon? Sure. Okay. That's okay. We'll get.
I took this much more literally. I wondered how many of us in the McCarthy era would have been willing to stand up for our neighbors who were accused of being communists if that meant that our own careers would be ruined and our family lives.
Well, it's interesting that you talk about that, because I heard a discussion on NPR raising exactly that point about Margaret McCarthy, or whatever her name is, who got...
Yeah.